This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. On Tuesday, voters in Burlington approved three gun control measures that have stirred up debate over gun control around the state. One of the restrictions would give police the power to seize guns in situations where there's reasonable suspicion of domestic violence. The second would ban firearms on the property of institutions where liquor is served. And the third requires that all guns be under lock and key when not in possession of their owner. Burlington Mayor Merle Weinberger spoke with VPR's Mitch Wortley about voters or after voters in the city approved the measures.
It was interesting to see how strong the results were in the face of what I think has to be called an overwhelming attempt to defeat them with a major campaign launched against them with a very little spent or done in the way of a campaign in favor of them. So I think that really needs to be understood and thought about. I think should cause some reflection and reconsideration of some long-held assumptions about the desirability and the support, the electoral support for common sense public safety measures in Vermont.
That's Burlington Mayor Merle Weinberger. While voters in Burlington approve the three gun control measures, they still have to be approved by state legislators before they can be put into action. And opinions in Montpelier are sharply divided on this issue. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll hear from folks who both support and oppose these restrictions. Lots of people have already sent in comments to us at VPR. Listeners, what do you think about the gun control restrictions Burlington voters just approved? Do they make sense to you, or do you think they go over the line and will become the first of more restrictive gun laws? You can join our discussion today by calling 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on our website, vpr.net/Vermont Edition. My guests today are Ann Braden, president and co-founder of Gun Sense Vermont, and Evan Hughes. He's vice president of the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs. Evan Hughes and Ann Braden, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon.
So before we get into the nuts and bolts of the three resolutions, I'd like you both to briefly explain the groups that you represent. Evan Hughes, who makes up the membership in the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs?
The Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs was founded in 1875 to represent the interests of the outdoor sporting shooting community. There are approximately 45 to 50 member clubs throughout Vermont in the Federation.
All right. And Ann Braden, briefly tell us about Gun Sense Vermont.
Well, we are a very new organization. We got started last March, a little less than a year ago, when it was clear at the State House that no action was going to be taken on gun violence prevention without an organized, mobilized group of people calling for it. And so since then, we've grown to have several thousand members, and we're really in this for gun violence prevention at a statewide level.
Well, and your organization, Gun Sense Vermont, initiated the three gun control resolutions that were on the ballot in Burlington. What was your reaction when you heard that voters had approved them?
Well, first off, it actually came out of the Burlington City Council. We supported their efforts, but they were definitely the initiators for this. And I really applaud them for taking the leadership on this. When there was no action at the state level, no action at the national level, Burlington stood up and said, you know, enough is enough, and something has to be done to better protect our communities. And so I was thrilled to see such overwhelming margins in favor.
Evan Hughes, you said before that you expected these resolutions to pass, but I think many people thought the final votes would be closer and were surprised that the final margins of victory were as large as they were. Why do you think approval was so strong?
The city got to formulate how they presented the issues to the taxpayers. And in some instances, those were not very accurate. And that's what prompted our more concentrated effort of education.
Well, as we just heard from the mayor, he mentioned that there was an all-out press from opponents. They spent a lot more than those who were in favor of these, and yet they were still outgunned. What do you mean when you say the information put out was inaccurate?
Well, in one ordinance, the public was informed that it was about guns and bars, and it's not. It's much more expansive than that. It covers the property controlled by a first-class liquor license establishment. So that could be most of the restaurants in Burlington would be impacted by that, and it extends beyond the interior of the building, it goes out into the parking lots.
Well, Ann Braden, let's talk. I think for listeners who are listening to this program who don't live in the Burlington area and may not be as familiar with this issue, let's talk about why you chose or why these three restrictive areas were chosen. Talk about the three areas we've talked about. Gun control when people are not in possession of their firearms, having them under lock and key. We've talked about when there is a threat of domestic violence. And as we were just talking about, guns can be banned in areas where liquor is sold. Can you talk about those three areas and why maybe they were targeted?
I think each of those measures can really do a wonderful job in helping keep our community safer. So Burlington was looking at, you know, they have a steady stream just like, you know, throughout Vermont. There's lots of incidents involving guns. You know, guns for drugs trade is escalating the number of gun incidents in our state, as well as, you know, the importance of safe storage is another piece where, you know, we don't need to have such a high rate of suicide in our state compared to other states. And there are things that we can do to correct that. And what the Burlington voters did by approving, you know, saying, you know, we don't need to let domestic abusers have such a free range in accessibility to guns. We don't need to have guns in places where alcohol is being consumed in large quantities. What they said is they sent this clear message to Montpelier saying it's time to take action on gun violence prevention. And what they with the margins that they put forward, they made it very clear that this is a winning issue and one that's a priority for Vermonters.
Well, as we're seeing from the comments that are coming in, opinions vary a lot. Lori wrote in, I occupy a duplex in Burlington and rent out the other half. A few years ago, I learned that my tenants were keeping unlocked, loaded firearms under their bed, which included an automatic assault weapon. Their explanation was just in case they had to defend themselves from an intruder. Given that my bedroom was on the other side of a 4-inch wall, I was extremely alarmed, but had no recourse other than to try to appeal to their common sense, as no laws concerning gun safety were on the books. Lori goes on to write, Props 4, 5, and 6 are a good start to that end. But see it coming feels quite differently about it and wrote in, get ready for crime to increase as soon as criminals know your guns are restricted, since theirs won't be. Prepare to reap what you sow, Vermont. Thus far, we have had little to no gun laws, and thus far, we have had little to no crime. That's all about to change. Listeners, what do you think about this issue? You can weigh in by calling 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Evan Hughes, there are a lot of people who may be shaking their head thinking, what's the big deal with these particular regulations? Kathy wrote in, the three items passed seem to be very reasonable and cannot infringe on anyone's ability to go hunting or the ability to protect their home from invasion. Talk about why restrictions like these are worrisome to you and others who oppose gun control.
The way the ordinance is worded about restaurants that have liquor licenses, a person going to or from hunting or shooting cannot have their unloaded firearm locked in the trunk of their vehicle in the parking lot of a restaurant that has a first-class liquor license. That person would face 90 days imprisonment and seizure of their firearm. That's not going to do anything about deterring crime or preventing accidents. It doesn't have any impact on that. And as far as firearms in the home, the question is, whose home is it? Is it the homeowner's or is it the city of Burlington's? And it probably is in conflict with the United States Supreme Court decision in Heller. And it just doesn't – it's a solution in search of a problem. We just don't have a problem with guns in Vermont. We have an extremely low crime rate, and we have an extremely high safety rate with firearms, even though we have a high degree of firearms ownership. And I believe we're the state with the second highest percentage of licensed hunters in the lower 48 states.
Talis wrote in, I am most concerned about households that have children and guns and making sure that safety comes first. And I think, Evan Hughes, it seems to be every year that we hear about children and even adults accidentally firing guns that were they found loaded in their homes. You mentioned that, you know, someone's home is in fact their castle. But what about that issue, that ensuring that guns stay locked with trigger locks or in a safe that's locked? What's wrong with that?
Well, before the Burlington City Council, a woman named Amy testified, and she talked about an incident where she had a relief from abuse order against a man, and that he kicked in the door of her house, punched her in the face. She grabbed a rifle that she had, a Henry 44 caliber lever action rifle, and held the person at gunpoint while she dialed 911. She waited 52 minutes for the police to arrive. What would she have done if she had to unlock that firearm and load it? It's her home. She was 50 years old. She made a decision on how she was going to store the firearms. There were no children present. Adults should have a capability of determining how they store their firearms in their homes, and we are an extremely safe state.
Hugh wrote in, I left Massachusetts in part because of infringement on my Second Amendment rights. I hope Vermont continues to respect the Constitution. James wrote in, Burlington is not the majority of Vermont. If you're a politician looking to stay in office, you better vote against these gun restrictions. And Braden, I'd like to ask you, Evan Hughes brought up some problems that he sees in the wording of some of these restrictions, specifically with restaurants and bars that sell alcohol. I'd like to get your response to some of the things he brought up, that maybe the restrictions that were just voted in Burlington are too broad.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of the details, it's up to the city attorney and the state lawmakers to sort those things out. But in terms of the big picture, let's keep in mind that 27 states have safe storage laws like this. That, you know, the American Medical Association has found that safe storage laws lead to a 70% reduction in the risk of suicide, which we have a large number of, and injury. And, you know, even the NRA states that a responsible gun owner has the duty to, quote, store guns so that they are inaccessible to children and other unauthorized users. You know, in terms of the domestic violence piece, 17 states have that measure or a variation that's even stronger. Women are 500 times more likely to be killed by a domestic partner if there is a gun involved. And, you know, with the guns and bars, it's one of those things where the big picture is about, let's not have guns mixing with alcohol. You know, the Burlington deputy police chief said that that's a priority for him, and I think most people, as we can see from the results from the election, most people agree with that. And so I think that these are all ways of making sure that guns are being used responsibly and not irresponsibly, and that they're, you know, it's something where support for the Second Amendment rights, that goes hand in hand with keeping guns out of the hands of criminals. And I really think that there's a way forward on this that will protect Second Amendment rights, but also keep our communities safer.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the three gun control measures that Burlington voters passed on Tuesday. Lawmakers in Montpelier and the governor will have to approve those measures before they can be made into law, and opinions across the state vary. My guests today are Evan Hughes from the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs and Ad Braden, president and co-founder of Gun Sense Vermont. You can join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phone lines now and take some comments. Let's go to Burlington and check in with Robert. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. So, Evan, this is not a reflection on the leadership of your organization, but it might be on some of the rank and file. So I was involved in some of the yes on 6 and 7 and 8 with signs and stuff. And I've had signs of about the dozen signs I put up, all but one, only one survived. And it was vandalized. And these folks, they think that it's a sacred right that's being attacked of them. They think that they're entitled to do whatever they want. They don't play by the rules in the political contest, yet they expect us to entrust to them lethal weapons in situations where we'd rather not, and they think it's an attack on their sacred right to bring their gun to the bar, you know. you know, if these guys think that they ought to have a carry conceal anywhere they want in the world, they should go down to New York City. It's the same U.S. Constitution, the same Second Amendment, and you do carry a concealed weapon in New York City without paperwork, you're going to see the inside of Rikers Island. And we want to do just these normal, moderate measures, and they object to that.
All right, Robert, we've got it. Let me take another phone call now. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Jim. You're on the program.
Hello,
go ahead.
Hey. It's getting so, in Burlington, they're getting so restrictive on us. Hey, I'm very close to moving out of Burlington, like to one of the other towns in Vermont. It's getting that bad. You know, the city commission tries to tread on our rights.
What do you mean? Be specific when you say it's getting so bad.
Example, like with this gun ordinance. Hey, I'm a responsible gun owner. They make, it's mostly common sense.
So you feel that, so you're thinking that these restrictions, if they're enacted, might make you think twice about staying in Burlington. All right, we've got it. Thanks for that call. Let's go now to Norwich and check in with Paul. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. My question is to Mr. Hughes. And unfortunately, the National Rifle Association has kind of fueled this paranoia, attempting to kind of muddy the debate about linking legislation with confiscation. And they refuse to see this as a public health issue. It's interesting that in Vermont, Act 169, which was implemented in 1975, required certification of completion of a hunter safety course before receiving a license. This was preceded in 1923 by Act 130, and that limited the size of gun magazines to 6 cartridges and banned automatic loading rifles. Well, if you look at the data going back to 1988, the annual rate of hunting-related accidents per 100,000 hunter license was 9 in 1988, 5 in 1998, 4 in 2008, and it continues to go downward. Those hunting regulations haven't resulted in confiscation of personal firearms, but have contributed to a safer environment for the hunters. So I guess the debate continues to be diverted to the Second Amendment, which really isn't being challenged. And it's being diverted away from coming up with some sensible gun safety legislation. And what I want to know from Mr. Hughes is, why isn't he participating in trying to bring about safe gun legislation and yet protect the rights of gun owners?
All right, we've got it. Let me throw that to Evan.
Okay. The Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs conducts more hunter safety and gun safety courses than anybody else in the state of Vermont. Our clubs provide the vast majority of hunter ed instructors, safety instructors. We've, on a continual basis, conducts safety courses. As far as the laws go, our laws work for us. I've heard discussion about New York City's laws versus our laws. Let's compare crime rates and accident rates with firearms between Vermont and New York City. And as far as the signs disappearing, all kinds of signs disappeared, not just the ones from the people in favor of those three articles.
All right. Well, we'll get to more of your calls and get to more of your comments. A lot of folks want to weigh into this issue on gun control after we take a short break. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're talking about the pros and cons of gun control resolutions passed by voters in Burlington this week. The proposals will have to be approved by Vermont lawmakers before they'd be put into law, and as you'd imagine, any issues concerning gun control stirs up lots of debate in Vermont. We're trying to hear from as many sides as possible today. My guests are Ann Braden, president and co-founder of Gun Sense Vermont. That's the organization that's been working to get some of these proposals on the ballot in Burlington. And Evan Hughes, Vice President of the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs. Listeners, you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Calvin wrote in, Vermont's Constitution requires the legislature to approve any proposed laws respecting the right to bear arms, even laws proposed by municipalities, like the measures passed in Burlington. One of many reasons behind this constitutional provision is to prevent a patchwork of different different gun laws from town to town and throughout the state. The Burlington proposals, even if reasonable, would be a dangerous precedent in moving towards a state where compliance with all of those various towns' laws would be impossible for sportsmen and those, including battered spouses, who carry weapons for protection. And Braden, what about that point, that if Burlington has one set of gun laws and, say, Montpelier or Rutland has different ones, does that get to be more complicated?
Well, I think what the Burlington voters did was they sent the message to Montpelier, you need to take action. You know, the state had not taken any statewide action last year. And so you end up at the local level pushing for it instead. And so they stood up and said, you know, they took a lead on this. And so now the question before lawmakers is, okay, we've got local measures on the table, we've got statewide measures on the table, and they have to figure out the path that makes the most sense for Vermont to go forward. And I personally feel like it would be great if we had a statewide reform. You know, it's Burlington needs to be safer, but also all the communities in Vermont need better better laws protecting them to keep guns out of the wrong hands. For example, having a universal background check system would have, you know, it would provide a systematic way to keep guns out of the wrong hands. It's proven to work, and it saves lives because it's not, you know, we're all connected. You know, people go into Burlington, they come out of Burlington. Every town in Vermont is dealing with this, you know, and we're not even just, it's not just about Vermont. You know, we're connected to the states around us. We're all neighbors. Part of a larger community. And as, you know, as drug dealers come in from other places and wreak havoc in our communities with a flourishing guns for drugs trade, you know, we have to be responding to that with laws. And we need to be putting up obstacles in the path of those people that shouldn't be accessing weapons.
Evan Hughes, I'd like to ask you, some people might say that if a city like Burlington can enact these types of measures, it will allow other parts of the state to see how and if they work, to see if it might lower accidental shootings or curb domestic violence-related deaths. So one might say that this might be a good testing ground. I'm wondering, do you see that as a problem?
Yes,
we do. Or might that be a good opportunity?
No, we see it as a problem. In 1988, the legislature put into effect the Vermont Sportsman's Bill of Rights, 24 VSA, Section 2295. And it said to the municipalities, we decide the matters of the sale, transfer, possession, ownership of firearms, ammunition, reloading equipment, trapping equipment, and fishing equipment. It also said, we have exclusive jurisdiction over hunting, fishing, shooting, and trapping. And it said to the municipalities, these are issues which are off limits to you. They established a uniform statewide standard. We haven't had a problem in this state. We're doing just fine. And as far as this guns for drugs issue, the guns aren't showing up in any other states. In 2011, Massachusetts did tracebacks, I believe, on 1,026 firearms to their sources of where they came from. The majority of firearms they traced back, which was approximately 450, the single largest source was the state of Massachusetts. Zero, none, came from Vermont. Our laws work for us. We're doing quite well here. The Vermont Sportsman's Bill of Rights has served us well, and we've got a standard, uniform set of laws for the entire state. In Burlington, if you drive down Shelburne Road towards Shelburne, the right west side of the street is Burlington. The left east side of the street is in South Burlington. So not only does the possessor of firearms need to know what the laws are in each town, they have to know what town they're in.
I want to go back. Eddie in St. Johnsbury asked Ann Braden, what is your opinion of Vermont's Sportsman's Bill of Rights that we just heard Evan Hughes talk about?
You know, I think the sportsman's that the law from the 80s, I think that it was put in place for a reason to, you know, keep that patchwork effect from happening. I think it does complicate things if you have municipalities deciding on a town by town level. But I think if there's no action at the state level, then towns feel the need to act. And so I think we have to either have a patchwork or larger reform at the statewide level.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's talk to Jerry, who's calling from Castleton. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. You know, there's a much deeper issue at root here than just gun control. I mean, you have the District of Columbia in Chicago. They have the strictest gun control laws in the nation. They also have the highest murder rates. You're worried about the domestic abuse. Recently, a much publicized incident in Burlington where the woman was beat with a baseball bat. I mean, I think a lot of the gun control issues are just people's, they want their conscience to feel better.
All right, Jim.
Well, if we have more stricter gun control, there's going to be less problems, and it doesn't work that way.
All right, Jerry, we've got it. I appreciate you calling in. I want to get to a couple more callers. Let's talk to Bob now, who's calling from South Woodstock. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Very good show, an important conversation. I think we need to keep our eye on the big picture in this one. We do have a problem in this state. Our youth firearm suicide death rate is the highest in the Northeast because we do not secure our guns in our homes at a sufficient number. And I really failed to see how guns in bars or unlocked firearms in the home where kids can get their hands on them or guns in the hands of domestic abusers fulfills any responsible gun owners or any responsible sportsman's rights. Burlington voters spoke very loud and clear on Tuesday. The status quo has deadly consequences, and if the state legislators refuse to try and fix the problem, communities will speak loud, as Burlington did, to make their community safer.
Okay, Bob, thank you for checking in. Again, our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation today, you're listening to Vermont Edition, and we're talking about three gun proposals that were passed by voters in Burlington. They still need to be approved by lawmakers in Montpelier before they'll go into effect, but they've stirred up a lot of different opinions, which we're hearing from today. Let's go to Dan now, who's calling from Wethersfield. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I had a question for the woman from Gun Sense about the reasonable suspicion of domestic violence provision. And my question is, who makes that decision that someone is reasonably suspected of domestic violence? Is that going to be police officers in the heat of the moment making that decision, or is there going to be judicial review of that decision? Do you guys have any, do you know how that's going to work?
Ann Braden.
Sure. The bill and the details of this came from the city council, so I'm not really the best person to answer. But in general, this is designed for the situation where, say a neighbor notices some sort of domestic violence incident. They call the police. The police show up, and what can often happen in these sort of situations is the woman says, no, we're fine. We're fine. You just go. We're fine. So the police are then looking at the situation, and there is, not quite enough evidence to make an arrest, but there is, there's a lot of evidence pointing to the idea that this something is not right here, if there's a gun right there and the coffee table, this gives them the ability to temporarily or in the hand possibly of the abuser, this gives them the ability to remove that gun from the situation for 5 days for a cooling off period. And one of the reasons that that's so important is because when the police leave, they close the door and it's just the woman and the man again, that is a time when there is such an escalated chance of risk of the situation to really explode out of control. And so what this is designed to do is, just give 5 days for a cooling off period so that you don't have disastrous consequences afterwards.
Evan Hughes, I'd like you to weigh in on that.
We have a right of due process of law. Last Monday, the Burlington Free Press published an editorial finding that article of the Burlington Ordinance proposals as a violation of the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And I'm not convinced that the city of Burlington did the best legal job in the world when they can't even cite the right state statute in their ordinance. Also, with regard to the the firearms in parking lots of restaurants, the city didn't even exempt off-duty police officers.
But I want to go back, though, looking at incidences of domestic violence. In a situation where police may have been called back repeatedly and they do find a weapon, you still think it's wrong for that weapon to be taken out of that situation, even if it might lessen the possibility that either one of those people involved might be shot?
Then let them get a warrant. And as far as a police officer seeing somebody with a gun in their hand when they come into a domestic violence situation or any other situation, that's not going to be the case very long. They're going to make sure that that gun is not in that any person's hand that they're dealing with.
All right. I think we've got time for a few more phone calls. Let's go to Huntington and talk with Barbara. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that, you know, I think it's crazy when we keep citing earlier laws like back in 1988. This is what we have for gun laws and saying that that's a reason not to change anything. You know, there was a time, too, when women and blacks couldn't vote. And we do have to change our laws and update them. So, you know, that's my comment. My question is, you know, what would the next step be in Montpelier? You know, why should legislators consider changing the charter for Burlington?
Well, let me ask both of my guests about that. Why don't I start with Ann Braden? What is the next step?
Well, I think the state lawmakers have now, they have local laws in front of them, and they have statewide laws and bills in front of them. And they have to figure out, okay, how can we best address gun violence prevention in this state? And so I think it's a complicated process, but I think that what we're hoping as an organization to do is to really build our grassroots organization so that we are ready to support those lawmakers that stand up and say, I'm ready to deal with this issue. You know, this is an issue that needs to be dealt with. The voters are calling for it, and I'm ready for that.
How optimistic are you, Anne, that this might pass?
I'm very hopeful. I'm not talking about necessarily it passing, you know, in the next 2 months. But I'm very hopeful that, you know, I think support for the Second Amendment rights, it really does go hand in hand with this idea of keeping guns out of the wrong hands. And I feel like that the tide has turned in terms of our awareness about the issues of gun violence in our communities, the way it rears its head with domestic violence, with guns and drugs. And the voters are making it very clear that it's time for us to be dealing with this as a state.
And Evan Hughes, what message will you present to the lawmakers in Montpelier to keep these resolutions from being approved?
The law that was enacted in 1988 is just as effective today as it was then. Laws don't go out of fashion, and they're not cans of tuna fish. They don't have expiration dates on them. If a law is working for our state, and this one is, we should keep it in place. And what Burlington is doing in the interest of a discussion about an issue or their disdain for a law is they've opened up a process where every municipality in this state can put on the March ballot that they want to be exempt from a law that they don't like, say Act 68. Why wouldn't every gold town in this state put it on the March ballot in 2015 that they want to be exempt from that law? They don't like it. They don't think it's fair, and they want it to be granted an exemption from it.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave this discussion there. Listeners, the conversation will continue online at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Ann Braden is president and co-founder of Gun Sense Vermont. Evan Hughes is vice president of the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs. Evan Hughes and Ann Braden, thanks very much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's crossover time at the State House. VPR's Bob Kinzel will join us to explain how it works and what bills are on the move. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Vermont lawmakers are spending this week at home for town meeting. The break marks the halfway point of the legislative session. VPR's Bob Kinzel joins me now to look at where key pieces of legislation are in the lawmaking process. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Nina.
So people at the State House refer to this time of the session as crossover. What does that term mean? Where does it come from?
Well, it really creates a deadline at the State House. It tells members of the House and Senate that if they want a bill to have a chance of being considered in both chambers this year, then that bill has to be voted out of its primary committee by a week from tomorrow. Otherwise, the sponsor of the bill would have to get an exemption. That's not an easy thing to do. So next week, most legislative committees will be spending a lot of time in committee cranking out the bills that they want to see passed this year.
All right. Well, there are three budget bills that lawmakers need to pass each year. Remind us of what those must-pass bills are.
Sure. Number one is the state budget for next year. Sometimes this can be a very controversial bill, but I've heard very few complaints about the budget this year. There'll always be some amendments on the floor to make some changes, but no big changes will be made. Number two is the transportation bill. This includes extra money for paving and road construction projects. And number three is the so-called capital bill. These are appropriations for state buildings and other state projects. But I don't expect a lot of fireworks over this legislation either.
Bills that we've been hearing a lot about lately include a ban on drivers using handheld cell phones and other devices. Where is that?
Well, this bill passed the House by a huge margin last month, like a 10-to-1 margin. Now it's being reviewed by the Senate Transportation Committee, and the chairman of that committee, Grand Isle Senator Dick Mazza, used to be an opponent of this bill. Now he supports it, and that's very, very important. And he supports it because the law enforcement community says it's needed to help enforce the law that bans texting while driving. So I think the bill's chances are very good. The governor doesn't like it, but I'd be surprised if he vetoed it. It could become law without his signature.
What's going on with the paid sick days bill?
Nina, this is going to be one of the most interesting bills to watch in the next 2 months. Right now it's in the House, and here's the question. Are there enough votes on the House floor to pass this bill? I'm not sure that anybody right now knows the answer to this question, and House leaders will be very reluctant to bring it to the floor for a vote unless they know it's going to pass. And the debate over this bill has been very emotional. Backers of the legislation feel very strongly that all workers are entitled to some sick time. It's a family issue. But there are members of the business community who say the issue is very complicated and that it needs more study. Right now, I don't know what's going to happen to this bill.
Huh. Well, another bill that's been percolating is the GMO labeling one. Where does that stand?
Well, this bill passed the House last year and recently passed the Senate Agriculture Committee. I think a bill is going to pass. The question is, will it become active when a number of other states have passed similar laws? That's the approach that was taken by the House last year. Or will Vermont go it alone? That's the approach taken by the Senate Agriculture Committee. And there are concerns that Vermont will face litigation if it goes it alone. So I wouldn't be all that surprised to see the Senate bill reflect the concerns raised in the House. And there's no doubt that the governor supports the bill and would sign that legislation.
Well, what are a few other examples of bills that you've been watching?
Well, will lawmakers consider any major changes to the way that Vermont finances education after 35 school budgets were defeated on town meeting day? I kind of doubt it. There just isn't enough time to do this. But they might consider a bill that calls for consolidation of school districts. The House Education Committee is looking at this bill. The legislation encourages towns to do this voluntarily in the next few years. And if they haven't done it by 2019, then a special panel will step in and help them do it. Another bill I'm watching is a bill that would raise the age to buy tobacco products from 18 to 21. Backers say the vast majority of adult smokers started smoking when they were teenagers. So for them, it's a huge health issue. But there could be some pushback from folks who say, hey, you know, you can go into the Army at 18. You should be able to smoke at that age. And then, Nina, there's legislation that deals with medical marijuana. Under our current law, there are 4 dispensaries and a cap of 1,000 people who can use medical marijuana. This bill creates 2 more dispensaries, eliminates the cap completely, and allows for the delivery of marijuana to people who are too infirm to drive to the dispensary. Last Friday, the Senate gave its preliminary approval to this bill. It'll be up for final approval on Tuesday, and then it'll go over to the House.
Wow, lots of things to keep your eye on. Vermont's legislative sessions are 2 years, and we're in the second year of the biennium. What pressure does that put on backers of some of these bills?
Oh, Nina, I think the pressure is huge, because if a bill doesn't pass this year, then you have to wait until next year, and you got to start the process all over again. So this is really crunch time.
And Bob, your guest tomorrow on Vermont Edition is Governor Peter Shumlin, and I imagine a lot of these issues we're going to be on the table for that. What else will you be talking about with the governor?
Certainly talk about ways to control property tax increases in the future. If the governor thinks there's anything that lawmakers can do this year to deal with this issue, we're also going to discuss a plan to increase the state minimum wage to $10 an hour over a 3-year period. And I'm sure we'll talk about the governor's plan to pay for a single-payer health care system. The administration says it will offer a menu of options next month that will raise roughly $2 billion. It won't be the administration's final plan, but it will let Vermonters know what some of the possibilities are.
All right. VPR's Bob Kinzel. Hey, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Nina.
The world's best-known sled dog race, the Iditarod, got underway in Alaska last Sunday, and among the people who will be following that race closely are the members of the Vermont Mushers Association. Those are folks who run sled dogs in the Green Mountain State. VPR's Sage Van Wing spoke to one of them last week.
Jimmy, you're going to have to stay.
The air is crisp, cold, and silent deep in the Green Mountain National Forest outside of Ripton, until Ed Bleckner drives up in an old truck with a large plywood box on the back.
Oh, Jimmy, you're going to have to wait, Jimmy.
Curious wet noses poke out through the hand-carved windows. He's brought 6 dogs to hitch up to his sled for a 15-mile ride over the snow. But first, he has to get the dogs out of the truck.
We take the dogs out of the box, which is called dropping the dogs, and hook them up to these short chains, so they're around the truck, and that way they can pee and do their thing.
This is Scuppy.
And then we harness them there and get the sled and everything ready. And in that process, there's always a lot of excitement because they're excited to go. People who aren't necessarily familiar with sled dogs don't realize that they're not only are they bred to do this, but they love to do it. Now, you can't make them do something they don't want to do. So, for instance, if a dog, you're out with a dog on the trail and they just stop for some reason, they don't want to go, you can't force them.
Bleckner has been mushing sled dogs for nearly 40 years. At the moment, he has 12 dogs, many of them older racing dogs who came to him from all over. He enjoys the process of getting these different dogs to work together as a team.
If you think about people, and you took people who, you know, didn't know each other, didn't necessarily get along or whatever, and you try to put them together on some kind of team effort, it usually takes a while to get. And oftentimes it takes a while for dogs to get used to each other, but it's just amazing how quickly they can adapt and how quickly they'll be able to pull together and work really well together.
Bleckner tries not to play favorites with his dogs, though he says he does develop a special relationship with the lead dog. Today, he's running a dog named Scuppy at the lead, but usually he hooks up Queens to the front of the pack. Before she came to him, Queens raced in the Iditarod.
You know, when I got started, the big type of racing was sprint racing, which still goes on. These are dogs that run very fast for a couple of days. And then the Iditarod came along and kind of changed the whole racing scene, and people got all interested in the long distance end of it.
The dogs have been barking from the moment the truck pulled up.
Hop on.
But as soon as Bleckner gives the command to run, they're silent.
Okay. Hey.
They leap forward and just pull.
The whole key and the whole reason, really, why people run sled dogs is that relationship that you have with the dogs. That's the whole key. So the better, the stronger that relationship, the better they're going to run, the happier they're going to be. And it takes a lot of love, a lot of caring, and a lot of respect to put together a successful team.
For VPR News, I'm Sage Van Wing.
Those are the sled dogs of Ed Blechner of Ripton. And that's it for our program today. Just a reminder that Governor Shumlin will be our guest tomorrow, and you can send your questions or comments for the governor to vermontedition@vpr.net. Another reminder, we always welcome your feedback on what you hear on Vermont Edition and topics that you'd like us to cover in the program. You can email your thoughts to vermontedition@vpr.net or post them on Facebook. And join us each day at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed our program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. From PEG TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.